Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Mussolini Trump edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a collection of web wisdom about Trump and the politics of violence, drug wars, people who saved your life, and much, much more. Let's listen in to episode 330.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Let me start by saying most of this week's show was supposed to be next week's show. The planned show we had for this week suffered a major technical failure, and well, we hope to recover it by next week, but in the meantime, you get this show. However, one of the topics that me and Matt were going to cover this week was the rise of political violence in the USA, centered around Donald Trump. Because of the timeliness of this topic, instead of putting it off, I decided to start with a clip from the Rachel Maddow Show about where she talks about how Trump is not only the center of this rise of violence, but is instigating it for political gains. Let's listen in.
Here's the context. Here's how I think we got here. And I think we got here via deliberate means. I don't think this was an accident. One of the really important, really intense things that's been going on in our country over the past few years that has mostly been happening outside of big time electoral politics has been a race issue and a justice issue and a civil rights issue and a public order issue, frankly, in cities and suburbs all over the country, where major controversies and at times public unrest has broken out in response to police killings of African Americans. In the St. Louis area, we saw Ferguson, Missouri go up like a cauldron there after the killing of an unarmed teenager named Michael Brown. In Chicago, it was dash cam footage of a 17-year-old named Laquan McDonald being shot 16 times by a Chicago police officer. In Cleveland, it was first just the story and then some almost unbelievable footage of Cleveland police rolling up on a 12-year-old boy in a city park and shooting him dead in an encounter that took less than 3 seconds. That was Tamir Rice, who was killed in Cleveland. So the St. Louis area, Chicago, Cleveland. Those are not the only three American cities that have proven to be real tinderboxes around issues of race and racism and policing and violence. But those three happen to be the three most recent stops on the itinerary of Republican presidential contender Donald Trump, whose rallies have featured racially charged incidents of violence for months now. But as Donald Trump's campaign left the Deep South and prepared to swing into Chicago tonight and Cleveland tomorrow, we have seen one part of this phenomenon is becoming more intense at Donald Trump rallies. There have been instances in the past where he has encouraged or at least praised the idea of violent actions by his supporters, when he's spoken wistfully about how great it would be to beat people up at his rallies, or he's told people that he would pay their legal fees if they beat up a protester on his behalf. He has done that in the past. But this sort of bloodlust, right, this half tongue-in-cheek, mostly serious call for a tougher America where there are more beatings, and where anti-Trump protesters should fear for their lives. As he heads into these tinderbox cities today and tonight, I just want you to watch how that part of candidate Donald Trump's rhetoric has escalated. That we have laid these out in chronological order. If you want to see the crescendo here, if you want to see the deliberate act that created what happened tonight in Chicago, well, watch where it came from. And where this culminates is what has happened over the course of today and into tonight. And it really is like nothing we've ever seen in mainstream American politics before. And tonight in Chicago, it really turned into playing with fire. But if you want to know where it came from and you want me to prove to you that it was deliberate what happened tonight in Chicago, well, here's where it came from.
If you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously. Okay? Just knock the hell. I promise you, I will pay for the legal fees, I promise.
I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks. That's true. I'd like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
In the good old days, they'd rip him out of that seat so fast. But today, everybody's politically correct. Our country's going to hell with being politically correct. Going to hell.
All right, get him out of here, please. Get him out. Get him out. Are you from Mexico? Are you from Mexico? Huh? Are you from Mexico?
Get out of here. Get out. Out!
Oh, this is amazing. So much fun. I love it. I love it. We having a good time? USA! USA! All right, yeah, get him out. Try not to hurt him. If you do, I'll defend you in court. Don't worry about it. He had four guys. They jumped on him. They were swinging and swinging. The next day, we got killed in the press. That we were too rough. Give me a break. You know? Right? We don't want to be too politically correct anymore, right, folks?
Get him out of here. Get him out. Get him out of here. Get him out. Yeah, get him out of here. Get him out. Get him out. So disruptive. Remember when Bernie Sanders, they took the mic away from him? That's not going to happen with us, folks. That's not going to happen. Remember that? He walked away from the mic and he stood back and he watched these two young girls talking to the audience and they said, we came to listen to him. And he was standing in the back as two women took the mic away. Now, that doesn't happen to us. Get that guy out of here.
He had some people, some rough guys like we have right in here, and they started punching back. It was a beautiful thing. I mean, they started punching back. In the good old days, this doesn't happen because they used to treat them very, very rough. And when they protested once, you know, they would not do it again so easily. But today they walk in and they put their hand up and they put the wrong finger in the air at everybody and they get away with murder because we've become weak. We become weak.
Anybody who tells you there is no connection between the behavior of the mob at these events and the behavior of the man at the podium leading the mob at these events is not actually watching what he has been saying from the podium. And what he has been saying and the way he has been egging this sort of thing on, it is escalating. I mean, that very last clip we just showed there from him, that was in Fayetteville, North Carolina on Wednesday night. And that was when the Trump supporter threw that sucker punch elbow in the face of a protester who was being taken out of the event. But if you want to know why things escalated today to the point where this Donald Trump rally had to be canceled tonight in Chicago because security fears, consider that that Trump supporter was charged with physically assaulting that protester at a Trump rally yesterday. He was arrested and charged yesterday. This is how Donald Trump today in St. Louis talked about violence at his rallies, talked about the rightness or wrongness of his supporters throwing punches at protesters and beating people up at his events.
You know, part of the problem and part of the reason it takes so long is nobody wants to hurt each other anymore, right? And they're being politically correct the way they take them out. So it takes a little bit longer. And honestly, protesters, they realize it. They realize that there are no consequences to protesting anymore. There used to be consequences. There are none anymore. So that's it. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Are they gone? Yeah, they're gone. Our country has to toughen up, folks. We have to toughen up. These people are bringing us down. Remember that. They're bringing us down. No reason for it. These people are so bad for our country, you have no idea, folks. You have no idea. They contribute nothing, nothing. They can get up, and when they're being whisked out, they can raise their bad finger up in the air and drive people, which is very unfair. And some people get very angry at that because you know what that represents. And then when they get a little bit overly angry, they're in trouble. The guy that raised his finger, no, that's no problem. That's no problem. Get out of here. Get out of here. Get him out. Get him out, troublemaker. Get him out of here. Hurting this country, folks, hurting this country. Go home to mommy. Go home and get a job. These are not the people that made our country great, but we're going to make it great again. But these are not the people. These are the people that are destroying our country.
That's the way that Donald Trump has been talking about protesters at his events. That's the way that he has been directing his supporters at events to treat those protesters. That was today. If you want to know what led up to Chicago tonight, that was Donald Trump's display of leadership and calming the waters at his event this afternoon. Terrible. Apparently, officials of some kind in St. Louis were worried enough about what was going to happen at that rally that it was suggested to Mr. Trump, at least he said it was, that maybe that event should be canceled. That event was not canceled. It went on. Mr. Trump lamented that we can't be rough enough with protesters anymore, that these are terrible people, that these are the people destroying our country, that we need to toughen up as a country. Anybody who gets in trouble because they do something to a protester who gives them the finger, that is the, yeah. That's what he did in St. Louis. They didn't cancel St. Louis. They did cancel Chicago. After the streets were full around the venue, after the venue itself was full of thousands of people, and they just let them all in, and then they called it off, and then they left and just let them fight it out, literally fight it out. American presidential politics isn't like this for anybody else. American presidential politics did not get this way on its own. This is the work of an American presidential candidate who deliberately made this happen. And the Republican Party is about to nominate him for president. To the point of that, the deliberateness of this strategy, Chris Matthews did some excellent coverage of the circumstance in Chicago. There is one portion of this, though, where Donald Trump talked about the political utility of the violence that broke out at this event tonight in Chicago, which, again, was canceled at the last minute after thousands of supporters and what appeared to be at least many hundreds of protesters were all crammed into the same venue with basically no guidance and almost no visible security. And then they pulled the plug on this event. This is how Mr. Trump described essentially the political utility of that for him tonight.
Is this going to affect the voting? I mean, everybody's voting on Tuesday in all these big states like Illinois, right there where this is things going on tonight in downtown Chicago. People are going to be voting in nearby Ohio. They're going to vote in Florida and Missouri, which is nearby. Did you think people who are coming out on the Republican side to vote are going to, how are they going to react to these pictures when they go to vote for you
or
against you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, two people told me that are experts say this increases the vote for Trump because, you know, what we're doing, we had a peaceful rally here, and you're not even allowed to have a rally anymore in this country. So we had a peaceful rally, and in order to make sure that nobody gets hurt, I said, let's postpone the rally. But you can't even have a rally in a major city in this country anymore without violence or potential violence. And I didn't want to see the real violence, and that's why I decided to call it off. I just thought it would be good. And I met with law enforcement, and we could have done it. We would have done it. We could have done it. But I decided not to do it. But it's very tough. I think, you know, a lot of people said, oh, this is going to increase it. This has nothing to do with my decision today. My decision is I just don't want to see people hurt. I don't think it's not worth it to have people hurt. We can come back and do it another time.
Donald Trump speaking with Chris Matthews on the air. As you hear there, making the case, you can't even have a rally in this country anymore without the threat of violence. This is a classic strongman political tactic that we are used to seeing in other countries, but not our own, certainly not in the last 50 years or so, in which political events are generated to bring violence at the edges into the center, so that violence at these events, which may start organically, is in effect spotlit and encouraged To the point where it becomes something that is legitimately out of control of anyone. And then the spectacle of political violence is itself seen as something that is a problem that needs to be solved by this strongman character who incited the initial incidents in the first place. I mean, it's just, it's political science in a way. It's not something that we're used to seeing in American politics. But trying to gin up political violence for its electoral utility is, I think, inarguably what we are seeing here. And I know that the Trump campaign will not say that is what they're doing. But when you look at the way that Mr. Trump has been talking about the organic existence of both protesters against him and violence toward those protesters at his events, when you look at the way that he has encouraged it in an escalating way, leading to this inevitable event tonight in Chicago, I think it's impossible to say that this was an accident.
Okay, on that depressing note, we will return after this break.
Hey, why so sad?
Oh, nothing really.
Not very convincing, Jane girl. Whatever it is, I've got just the cure for it.
One, two, three, four.
Did you know CITR has a women's collective? This brand new collective is all about providing and fostering a community for women who are or who want to be in radio, fighting the gender disparity in media, and centering women's voices and issues. If you are a female-identified person or ally who's already involved in radio or wants somewhere to start, this collective is for you. Email womenscollective@citr.ca for more information and to get involved.
And tune in Friday at 6 p.m. for the collective show, Lady Radio. Featuring music, interviews, events, news, commentary. Basically anything we care to talk about.
See you then.
Well, how do you like it?
There's only one word for it. Terrific.
You know, I'm so proud of it, it's almost indecent of me.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, your political violence-free skeptical radio show. And we're back. On the topic of violence, next we're going to hear a clip from In a Nutshell about the failure of the war on drugs. Let's listen in.
Over 40 years ago, U.S. President Richard Nixon declared drug abuse public enemy number one, starting an unprecedented global campaign, the War on Drugs. Today, the numbers are in. The war on drugs is a huge failure with devastating unintended consequences. It led to mass incarceration in the US, to corruption, political destabilization and violence in Latin America, Asia and Africa, to systemic human rights abuses across the world. It negatively affected the lives of millions of people. All of this while we waste billions of dollars every year only to create and fuel powerful drug cartels. While the goal of the war on drugs seems less achievable than ever, a world without drugs. How could this happen? The core strategy of the war on drugs is no drugs, no problems. So almost all of the efforts in the last few decades have been focused on eradicating the supply of drugs and incarcerating drug traffickers. But this ignores the most fundamental of market forces, supply and demand. If you reduce the supply of anything without reducing the demand first, its price goes up. This might lower sales for many products, but not for drugs. The drugs market is not price sensitive. Drugs will be consumed no matter what they cost. So the effect is to encourage production of more drugs and recruitment of more traffickers, which increases availability. This is also known as the balloon effect. Even if drug production or a major supply route is destroyed, the supply for the end user is not reduced. A perfect example of this is crystal meth. The US government tried to stop its production by strictly regulating the sale of chemicals used to manufacture the drug. This forced big meth producers out of business, but the unintended consequences were that thousands of small-scale operations started all over the country, mostly in small towns and rural communities, using chemicals that weren't regulated. In response to this, some US states wanted to reduce the supply of homegrown meth by regulating even more chemicals, which reduced small-scale meth production drastically. But the supply of meth still stayed the same. Mexican drug cartels immediately took over and opened big production operations. Their meth was even better than it was before, and they had loads of experience in smuggling. So all these efforts made meth production more professional, the drug more potent, while supply wasn't reduced at all. You can't win this war on the supply side. Not only are drugs widely available, demand unbroken, and some drugs purer than in the past, with a budget of around $30 billion, the US Drug Enforcement Agency has an efficiency rate of less than 1% when it comes to stopping the flow of drugs into the US and inside the US. For many minors around the world, it's as easy to get illegal drugs as alcohol. But it doesn't stop here. Prohibition may prevent a certain amount of people from taking drugs, but in the process, it causes huge damage to society as a whole. Many of the problems we associate with drug use are actually caused by the war against them. For example, prohibition makes drugs stronger. The more potent drugs you can store in as little space as possible, the more profit you'll make. It was the same during alcohol prohibition, which led to an increased consumption of strong liquor over beer. The prohibition of drugs also led to more violence and murders around the world. Gangs and cartels have no access to the legal system to settle disputes, so they use violence. This led to an ever-increasing spiral of brutality. According to some estimates, the homicide rate in the US is 25 to 75% higher because of the war on drugs. And in Mexico, a country on the front line, an estimated 164,000 have been murdered between 2007 and 2014. More people than in the war zones of Afghanistan and Iraq in the same period combined. But where the war on drugs might do the most damage to society is the incarceration of non-violent drug offenders. For example, the United States, one of the driving forces of the war on drugs, has 5% of the world's total population, but 25% of the world's prison population, largely due to the harsh punishments and mandatory minimums. Minorities suffer because of this especially. African Americans make up 40% of all US prison inmates. And while white kids are more likely to abuse drugs, black kids are 10 times more likely to get arrested for drug offenses. Okay, but is there actually something different we can do? Is there a way out of this mess? In the 1980s, Switzerland experienced a public health crisis related to heroin use. HIV rates skyrocketed and street crime became a problem. Swiss authorities tried a new strategy, harm reduction. They opened free heroin maintenance centers where addicts would be treated and stabilized. Here, people would be given free heroin of high quality, they would get clean needles and have access to safe injection rooms, showers, beds and medical supervision. Social workers helped them find housing and deal with other problems in their lives. The results were a sharp drop in drug-related crime, and two-thirds of the people in the centers got regular jobs because now they could focus on getting better instead of financing their addiction. Today, over 70% of all heroin addicts in Switzerland receive treatment. HIV infections have dropped drastically. Deaths from heroin overdoses have dropped by 50%. And drug-related street sex work and crime has been reduced enormously. So there are methods that are not only way cheaper, but also actually work instead of creating more problems. Drug prohibition led to a system that bulldozes human rights, costs vast sums of money, and creates a lot of human misery, all in pursuit of an unobtainable goal. After 40 years of fighting, it's time to finally end the war on drugs and move on to something better.
From the war on drugs to the war on booze, this next clip is from Stuff They Don't Want You to Know about the ways prohibition shaped the U.S.
Pardon me, friend. Have you been drinking alcohol?
Well, if this is the case, then that's completely fine if you're in the United States, you're of the right age, and you're not, you know, operating heavy machinery or at work. This week, Scully, Matt, and I are looking at prohibition because, as you probably know, if you look at the history of the United States, alcohol was not always legal. In 1919, Congress ratified the 18th Amendment, banning the manufacture, transit, and importation of alcohol, and this went into effect in 1920. The United States was theoretically a completely dry country. Advocates of this plan saw alcohol as
a moral threat, and without the crippling abuses of this demon drink, there's no telling what this great nation could do.
They predicted that without alcohol, you know, flooding the streets, that crime would go down. They predicted that the public health would be better and the moral character, whatever that was supposed to mean at the time. We know, of course, that Congress agreed, right, and they passed the amendment, and we know that in 1933, Congress and most of the nation decided they were wrong, and alcohol was legal again and has been ever since. However, this strange experiment in morality and public health didn't disappear in 1933. In fact, prohibition left the United States with several long-term serious effects which continue in the modern day. Here are three. Number one, prohibition was massively expensive. So expensive. Picture a number in your head. No, more than that. Like proportionately more than that. In a day and age where the average Ford factory worker made $5 a day, that was good money back then, prohibition cost $300 million just to enforce. But there were other hidden costs too, aside from, you know, just the cost of G-men salaries to go and bust bootleggers. And one of those biggest costs was tax revenue. On a national level, the United States lost $11 billion of tax revenue between 1920 and 1933 just because of prohibition. And this has an interesting effect too that I'll get to in a second, because the next hidden cost was the thousands of jobs that people lost. Now, advocates of prohibition had painted a somewhat optimistic, is literally the nicest word we can use. They had painted an optimistic picture of life in a dry America. And what they said was, well, without people spending all of their money on booze, several things will happen. They said sales of other goods and products will shoot up. So, you know, bubblegum, soda pop, stuff like that. They said that property prices would rise, landlords would make more in rent because bars would close down, and the neighborhoods would become safer, more desirable places to live. Funny story, none of that happened. What actually happened was much worse. We mentioned those thousands of people who lost their job. Well, they weren't just brewers, they weren't just distillers, they weren't just guys driving around a booze delivery van or whatever. There were also waiters at restaurants across the nation that closed because without a liquor license, they were not profitable. There were also people who worked in the entertainment industry, movies, live shows, dance clubs, who also closed. And here is maybe the most immediate way this affects you if you live in the United States today. Because what did states do to make up for all this lost tax revenue in a prohibition world? Income tax, my friend. It's true, prohibition may be one of the reasons that you, depending upon the state in which you live, pay the amount of income tax you do today. But money isn't everything, right? You know, that's the thing people always say is like, oh, at least you have your health, which brings us to number two, public health. Well, as you could see, prohibition was successful in that it reduced drinking rates for people. Not a lot of people are gonna go out and start stumbling through a black market to find one shot of Evan Williams or Four Roses or whatever they were drinking at the time. But despite this, people did die from alcohol consumption. Actually, a lot more people died consuming illegal alcohol than would have if prohibition never happened. And maybe they got off lucky, because if you didn't die, you still had a chance of being paralyzed or struck blind, which sounds positively biblical, from drinking tainted alcohol. Because it's not like you couldn't find alcohol, you just weren't supposed to find it. Oh. And one other thing, interesting fact, at the end of Prohibition, there were more alcoholics than there were at the beginning of Prohibition. So if we're talking about how to find illegal alcohol, this leads us to number three, and maybe one of the biggest lasting effects of the Prohibition policies of the 20s, and that is the rise of organized crime. The Dick Tracy days, you know, the Untouchables versus Al Capone, the Kennedy family, allegedly. We have to say allegedly at that part. But the rise of organized crime was unprecedented. Imagine the advocates of fighting this moral panic called alcohol. They said that crime would decrease. But that is the opposite of what happened. Crime increased, including violent crime, because these people found such a lucrative financial opportunity smuggling alcohol, manufacturing alcohol, owning different pharmacies or speakeasies where they could peddle it to the public. And with so much money in play, law enforcement wasn't able to fight it as well as you might think. In fact, law enforcement was often in on the game. Not just local law enforcement, not just the cops, and the judges too. Not just the judges, but also, you know, the state legislature members. Well, not just them, but also people in Congress. You see where we're going with this. The massive amounts of money generated by organized crime's alcohol industry, which, if you remember, already had a pre-existing infrastructure from back when it was legal, this stuff poured into law enforcement and gave rise to organized corruption. And the fortunes that were made in this trade changed the economic face of the United States. So what we find when we look at prohibition is that in this time, there were so many actual conspiracies, not conspiracy theories, actual groups of people working together in secret to break the law and to make money off of it. And of course, that leads us to one of the most important points for some of you watching today, and that is, did prohibition end? Well, yes, prohibition of alcohol ended, but prohibition as a practice continues today, not just in the United States, but in other countries. Of course, you are probably most familiar with the prohibition of marijuana, which is slowly eroding on a state-by-state basis, and we have to look back at the historical context here to ask ourselves what lessons learned from prohibition of alcohol can be applied to the prohibition of marijuana.
We'll be back after this message.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker and CITR 101.9 FM, your source of fun, facts, and beyond. And we're back. Okay, shifting gears. We have a trio of clips from SciShow. The first is about the three people who probably saved your life. Then we have Why Do We Hallucinate? And Do People Have Pheromones? Let's listen in.
Have you ever saved someone's life? Maybe you pulled a kid out of the street just in time, or fished a friend out of the river, or did the Heimlich maneuver on that guy sitting next to you at the deli. There's a small group of people in history, let's just call them what they were, nerds, whose scientific contributions have saved, not that it's a contest, like hundreds of millions, if not billions of people over time, including you, probably. Now, this isn't a comprehensive list or anything. Frankly, history is full of life-saving, world-changing scientists. We just picked three of them. And it's important to remember that science is both collaborative and cumulative. Researchers work with a whole team of people and build on the work of those who came before them. No scientist is an island. But these are people who spearheaded both simple and revolutionary discoveries, from proving that germs exist, to convincing doctors to start washing their hands, to creating vaccines to stop common diseases. First up, the guy whose name you'll find on nearly every gallon of milk at the grocery store, Louis Pasteur, the founder of germ theory and the father of microbiology. Born in rural France in 1822, as a kid, Pasteur was more interested in art than science, earning a Bachelor of Arts before turning his focus to chemistry and physics. He liked the idea of putting science to practical use in industry, and some of his early work focused on figuring out how to better manufacture wine. Hey, it was France. Of course, people had been making alcoholic beverages since practically forever, but it was Pasteur who gave us our modern understanding of the fermentation process. He showed that it's the action of living, multiplying microorganisms, specifically yeast, that turns sugar into booze. That might be common knowledge today, but back then, people didn't know much, if anything, about microbes. There had been some speculation about what we now call germ theory, the idea of microorganisms organisms might cause some diseases and make food spoil. But the prevailing scientific theory of the time was something called spontaneous generation, the notion that some organisms just sort of appeared out of thin air or came to life from decaying organic matter. Now, I'm not kidding, but for a long time, people thought that baby mice came out of decaying hay and maggots were born from rotting meat. And even after those specific things were disproven, people still believed that spontaneous generation was a thing under certain circumstances. But not Louis. Building on the work of an 18th century Italian physiologist named Lazzaro Spallanzani and others, Pasteur conducted what ended up being one of the most important experiments of all time. He boiled some broth in a swan-necked flask, effectively sterilizing it, so there were definitely no breeding bacteria or anything. The container allowed filtered air to enter the flask, but would catch any microbes in the bend of the neck. Then, he waited. And nothing happened. The broth never spoiled, meaning microbes weren't just appearing out of thin air. But if he tipped the glass so that the broth touched that filtering point in the neck that was catching all the microbes from the incoming air, the broth quickly began to go bad. That one simple experiment showed that life didn't just spontaneously appear out of nothing, but there were microbes in the air all around us. Basically, he proved that germ theory was real. With his newfound understanding of microbes in hand, Pasteur hit the bottles again, experimenting with techniques to keep wine and milk from spoiling. Then in 1862, he found that heating up wine without actually boiling it would still kill bacteria and keep it from spoiling. That's the process we now call pasteurization, and it's still used today to protect and preserve a number of foods like milk and other dairy products. By this point in his life, Pasteur was in his mid-40s and he wasn't doing too well health-wise. He had a stroke and ended up partially paralyzed. But even so, he continued his experiments and went on to invent the first laboratory-developed vaccine for chicken cholera. He then went on to create vaccines for more diseases like anthrax and rabies. The doctor Edward Jenner, who died about a month after Pasteur was born, had already discovered the smallpox vaccine in the late 1790s. But it wasn't until Pasteur proved germ theory that people really began to understand how viruses and bacteria worked, and with it, the real science behind vaccination. You really can't oversell the importance of getting the world on board with the idea that microbes can spread, causing infection and disease. So the next time you crack open a nice bottle of wine, don't forget to raise a glass to Pasteur. In fact, Pasteur greatly influenced our next legendary lifesaver, the British surgeon who completely transformed surgical practices, or as I like to think of him, the guy who finally got doctors to wash their hands. Joseph Lister started life in Essex, England in 1827. He was born into a wealthy Quaker family, and his father was an amateur scientist who helped design microscope lenses in his spare time. Lister was interested in science from a young age, and by college, he knew that he wanted to both work as a surgeon and do research to help improve medical knowledge in general, which, as it turns out, was desperately needed at the time. Let me paint a little picture for you. You're living in Europe in the mid-1800s, you fall off a ladder and break your leg. Your friends chuck you onto a cart and wheel you to the hospital. The doctor says they have to operate, and you don't get any anesthesia because it's not really a thing yet. The surgeon walks in with dirty hands, unsterilized equipment, and an apron he likes to keep stained and bloodied for the street cred. You pass out from the pain, and when you wake up, your chances of surviving the oncoming infection are less than 50-50 on a good day. In a decent hospital. That is the world Lister walked into after finishing his doctorate in the early 1850s. But to be fair, we can't be too hard on the surgeons. This was before Pasteur proved germ theory, and the common belief was there wasn't much they could do, since some wounds just spontaneously generated infections. But Lister wondered if there actually was a way to prevent those infections. He started noticing that patients with simple fractures, where a broken bone didn't pierce the skin, were far more likely to recover than those with an open wound exposed to the air. This suggested that rather than springing from the wound itself, infection must somehow get in from the outside, and he started washing his hands and clothes before operating. Around that time, he became a professor of surgery in Glasgow and read about Pasteur's groundbreaking work on germ theory. It made a lot of sense to Lister. He figured that if outside germs were infecting wounds, then killing those germs should, in theory, prevent infection. Now, Pasteur stopped wine and milk from spoiling by heating them up, but it's a lot harder to do that to human flesh. So Lister knew he needed to find the right chemical disinfectant. He chose carbolic acid, otherwise known as phenol, which is a kind of acid that's extracted from coal tar. At the time, it was being used to disinfect sewers, and in 1865, Lister began experimenting with a diluted form of phenol, using it to sterilize his hands, instruments, wounds, and bandages. He even sprayed it into the surrounding air. After collecting more than a year's worth of data, he published a paper explaining his new antiseptic technique, one that had led to a dramatic drop in post-operative patient deaths. But, like so many discoveries, his new protocol was slow to gain traction. Some doctors thought it was too slow and expensive, or tried it but didn't clean properly so it didn't work as well. Others still just didn't believe in germs. But by 1880, after more than 10 years of incredible results, his antiseptic principle was nearly universally accepted. Lister continued to improve surgical practices throughout his career. For example, he introduced stitches made from sterilized catgut, which would dissolve instead of having to be pulled out. He went on to become Queen Victoria's personal surgeon and won a bushel of prestigious honors, including a lordship for his many contributions. And maybe most prestigious of all, Listerine mouthwash? That was named after him. That Pasteur Lister 1-2 punch has probably saved billions of lives over the last 150 years. Which brings us to our next science hero, who took preventative life-saving to a whole new level with an arsenal of modern vaccines, starting with the shots you probably got as a baby. Maurice Hillman was born the youngest of 8 children on a Montana farm in 1919. His life got off to a rough start when his mother and twin sister died during his birth, and he was raised on his uncle's farm, tending chickens and reading Charles Darwin. Then he went on to do some scientific research of his own. By his mid-20s, Hillman had already helped develop his first human vaccine, one designed to help protect overseas soldiers from encephalitis. We've talked before about how vaccines work, but in a nutshell, they trigger your immune system to make antibodies against a particular disease without actively making you ill with that disease. This creates a kind of memory for your immune system, so if you run into that disease in the airport or lunchroom or whatever, your immune system will be like, hey, I know you, and start cranking out antibodies to fight it. Generally, to make a vaccine, you first have to mass produce the virus or bacteria by infecting cells grown in cultures, or sometimes chicken eggs. Then once you've got a good working supply, you can work on weakening that pathogen to turn it into a vaccine. Basically, you want to administer just enough virus or bacteria to get the antibodies flowing without getting anyone too sick. And Hillman was like the Superman of this process. Through his research on the influenza virus, he found that people did often develop an acquired immunity to the virus's small but constantly evolving mutations. They did that on their own without a vaccine. But every now and again, the virus made a major genetic leap, one big enough to leave people with no resistance and putting the population at risk for a wide-scale pandemic. For example, in 1957, Hillman heard about a really bad influenza outbreak in Hong Kong and suspected a new strain was spreading. Once he and his colleagues got their hands on a sample of the virus, they found that most people did in fact lack the necessary antibodies to protect themselves from it. So, fearing the worst, Hillman got a bunch of manufacturers to immediately start cranking out a vaccine. Over the next 2 years, about 2 million people died worldwide from that Asian flu, but the total would have been far higher without Hillman's foresight and emergency vaccine. Around that time, Hillman joined the Merck Pharmaceutical Company and started developing new vaccines against common childhood diseases. For example, an American virologist named John Enders had come up with a measles vaccine, but it proved too toxic to use. Hillman developed an improved version by growing a weaker strain in chicken embryos, and that vaccination alone is estimated to save over 1 million lives every year. Then Hillman developed a mumps vaccination by isolating the virus from a swab from his own daughter's throat and followed the same protocol he'd used on measles. Later, he combined the two with a third one for German measles, or rubella, creating the still popular MMR vaccine you probably, hopefully, got as a toddler. His team went on to develop many more vaccines, including those for hepatitis A and B, chickenpox, meningitis, pneumonia, and others. They also contributed to a bunch of other major scientific breakthroughs, including isolating a new family of viruses, the adenovirus, a common cause of upper respiratory infections in children and adults. And like the work of Lister and Pasteur, Hillman's research has since influenced generations of researchers, paving the way for more medical breakthroughs and saving more lives.
When I say hallucination, you probably think of one of two things. Psychotropic experimentation, like a dude in a hemp shirt tripping at a fish show watching rainbows melt into puddles. Or mental illness, like someone doing things because the voices in their head told them to when ending up in the hospital or in jail. A few centuries ago, most people would have ascribed hallucinations to the influences of ghosts, gods, or witches. Today, we understand them as the result of neurological disturbances. And the truth is, hallucinations aren't necessarily a sign of mental illness, drug use, or spirit vengeance. Rather, they can be caused by lots of different things. So while not everyone has experienced hallucinations, it's important to understand that everyone is capable of hallucinating under the right circumstances. In fact, a good number of us will experience some type of hallucination in our lifetime. I know I have. Like if you've lost the use of one of your senses, like your sight or smell, but still smell things from time to time, then you've hallucinated. If you've been under a ton of stress and heard someone tell you what to do only to find that there's no one there, then you've hallucinated. If you've driven by a bus stop and for a split second saw your deceased father sitting on the bench reading a newspaper, then you've hallucinated. It's weird, I know, but the one thing I can assure you is that the science behind these phenomena is very real. Whether they're fun, enlightening, confusing, or terrifying, all hallucinations involve sensing things that appear to be real, but actually are a product of the mind. They're not dreams. You have to be awake to truly hallucinate. Instead, they're sensory disturbances. Coming in a variety of flavors. You can see light patterns and objects that aren't there, smell imaginary odors, hear voices and other sounds, or feel physical sensations like crawling skin or your own organs moving. Even out-of-body, near-death, and sleep paralysis experiences are types of hallucinations. But to understand what's not real, you first have to understand how your brain judges something to be real in the first place. This involves the sister processes of sensation and perception.
two different things.
Your sensory organs receive visual, auditory, olfactory, and tactile clues pulled from the outside world in a process called sensation. That raw data is then sent to the brain, where it's processed, giving it meaning, putting it into context, in the process of perception. So basically, the brain turns sensory input into meaningful information to create your own model understanding of the world. The more sensory data you collect, the more they inform that model of how you perceive the world to work. And most people's models more or less agree on the big stuff. The sky is blue, the dogs bark, kittens cannot fly, and snow is cold. But if that normal copacetic brain activity gets disturbed by, say, a dose of LSD, a seizure, a disease, or a mega blow to the head, this model can get shaky, eventually diverging from its normal representation of the world. Then, suddenly, a flock of kittens fly by and a fiery rose-scented rain while calling your name! Depending on the type of brain tweak, these hallucinations may take different forms. Interesting, random, or scary, the good news is they all give us potential to learn about what the heck is going on up here. Obviously, outside substances can spur some wacky activity in your mind, and most ancient cultures have some tradition of vision questing aided by some psychotropic substance. I'm not gonna get too into drugs today, but you should understand that different compounds, whether found in plants, animals, fungus, or synthetically made concoctions, affect the brain very differently, meaning that even if they all cause hallucinations, they may be using very different pathways. For example, most researchers agree that LSD garbles the senses in a psychobiochemical way by affecting specific feel-good serotonin receptors found in the brain's cerebral cortex and thalamus regions responsible for sensory perception. Caffeine, on the other hand, works in an entirely different way. Australian researchers have linked consuming excessive amounts of coffee with increased risk of auditory hallucinations. Caffeine sort of gooses the physiological effects of stress, including the increased production of the body's naturally occurring stress hormone cortisol, which can lead you to hear things that are not actually there. But there are many reports of healthy, non-caffeinated people experiencing vivid auditory hallucinations, often when under extreme stress. There have been recorded cases of, for example, someone breaking their leg while alone in the woods and just wanting to curl up and die. But a strong voice, not just a thought, but something that seemed actually audible, telling them they needed to get up and move to survive. Grief is its own kind of stress, of course, and hallucinations have been known to occur in otherwise healthy people during periods of extreme grief. In fact, people seeing a departed loved one or hearing their voice can be a common part of the grieving process. But hearing voices is a symptom we typically associate with mental illness, and while it's true that 70% of schizophrenics report hearing voices regularly, it's not necessarily a scary thing. In fact, one Dutch study found that a good number of mentally stable people enjoyed hearing pleasant support of voices in their heads. Exactly how a person experiences auditory hallucinations is still fuzzy, but some neuroimaging studies suggest that it may have to do with a failure of the brain's frontal speech area. This is the part that usually lets your sensory areas know that the sound they're hearing is self-generated, like something you're just thinking to yourself. But if that signal doesn't get sent, then the brain gets confused as to where that voice it's hearing is coming from. Brain scans have also shown that people with schizophrenia have abnormalities in the areas associated with memory. That might exacerbate this failure to identify the words that show up in their mind as being part of their own inner monologue. Here's something interesting, though. In the total absence of sensation, the brain still leaps to perception, wanting to maintain that connection. For example, some people who suddenly lose their ability to smell often experience phantasmia, a type of olfactory hallucination. And yeah, if you smelled wildflowers and baking cookies, it might not be so bad. But unfortunately, the most common odors are the bad ones, like puke, poop, and rotting stuff. In these cases, your brain is overcompensating for its lack of olfactory input by pulling from the memories of old scents and making it seem like you're smelling them for real. And it's possible that the brain is offering up these disagreeable odors because those very smells had just been suppressed by certain neurons that have since turned off. And it doesn't just stop with smells. In fact, one of the most fascinating ways to see visual hallucinations is to go blind. Charles Bonnet syndrome, or CBS, is a condition that can cause otherwise healthy people with macular degeneration or loss of vision to experience complex visual hallucinations. The condition was first described by Swiss naturalist Charles Bonnet in 1760 after watching his nearly blind grandfather describe seeing visions of birds, buildings, and ladies, among other things. Patients with CBS report seeing images ranging from simple geometric shapes and colors to vivid, detailed scenes, often involving faces and, for some reason, lots of little people. But these images are not interactive. The experience is more like watching a movie with the sound sound off, and what patients see is unrelated to anything they're thinking, feeling, or doing at the time. And none of the faces are familiar. Some are pleasing, but others are deformed, and they often have big, misshapen teeth. These types of hallucinations are very different from psychotic hallucinations, which tend to be interactive and actively address the patient, whether to support, berate, threaten, or jeer at them. Instead, CBS hallucinations are more like those people with olfactory damage who start to hallucinate smells. When a person's vision no longer functions, the visual part of their brain can become hyperactive in the absence of stimuli that it was used to. So it starts firing off images, trying to sort of keep the story going, guessing what it might be seeing if it could still see. Interestingly, the same phenomenon can be achieved under visual sensory deprivation. One study blindfolded volunteers for 4 days, and in the end, 10 of the 13 subjects reported seeing various levels of hallucinations. Different localized parts of the brain are often involved in specific hallucinations too, like there's an area for seeing buildings and landscapes, and one just for cartoons. There's also a region in the temporal lobe called the fusiform gyrus, which is where we process the images of people's faces. So damage to this area can cause prosopagnosia, or face blindness, the inability to recognize faces, sometimes even your own. But overactivity in this sliver of the brain can cause a person to hallucinate and start seeing, you guessed it, faces. Not only that, but the front part of this region specializes in registering teeth and eyes specifically, so it may be involved in the phenomenon of hallucinators seeing faces with crazy big teeth. So even though you and your brain may sometimes see things a little differently, sometimes a lot differently, you can think of hallucinations as particularly vivid reminders of just how delicate, complicated, and freaking amazing your brain is. Take care of it, and it will likely do its best to take care of you. In the late 19th century, American entomologist Joseph Lintner discovered a small army of male silk moths crowding a female outside his window. This was not something Lintner was used to seeing, and he guessed that the frenzy of male attention had to do with some kind of chemical perfume the female was emitting. He was right, and although there wasn't a name for it yet, Lintner was watching the actions of pheromones, chemical signals that help some species communicate. Since then, scientists have found that lots of living things, especially social insects, use pheromones to some degree. But there's at least one species that continues to puzzle pheromone researchers: humans. I don't want to dash anyone's hopes of chemically attracting a Valentine this year, but I'm just gonna put this out there. So far, no one has definitively identified a human pheromone. Though that hasn't stopped loads of companies from marketing so-called pheromone perfumes, what they say is like sexual mojo in a bottle. Of course, just because they haven't been found doesn't mean they can't exist, but even if they do, they might not hold that much sway over our behavior. Pheromones are made of all kinds of molecules, and they're usually detected by smell. Depending on the species, they might travel through air or water, or just be deposited straight onto the recipient. The goal is to prompt some kind of behavioral or psychological reaction. From observing dogs in heat to angry swarms of bees, humans have long suspected that animals were capable of quietly communicating certain messages like, "Hey, let's mate," or "Help, I'm dying," or "Danger, danger!" But it wasn't until 1959 that technology finally allowed Nobel-winning German chemist Adolf Butenandt and his associates to separate and chemically identify the first official pheromone called bombycol, which was released by female silkworm moths to attract mates. Butenandt and his crew showed that exposure to a mature lady moth induced a particular behavior in a receiving male moth, in this case, a whole lot of excited wing fluttering. They then isolated and then synthesized bombycol molecules and showed that they had exactly the same effect on males. That's more or less how new pheromones are identified today, by pinpointing specific behaviors and then nailing down the exact molecules causing them. But before we get into whether humans might have them and whether it even matters, let's talk about how they work in other animals and even plants. We tend to think of pheromones as aphrodisiacs, but the truth is different species actually use them to silently communicate all sorts of different things. Though yeah, a lot of them do boil down to sex, like the androstenone in boar saliva that makes fertile sows assume the mating position when they catch a whiff. But other pheromones induce aggression or alarm, advertise territorial boundaries, promote parent-offspring bonding, or just generally keep social behaviors in check. Pheromones fall into two broad categories. Releaser pheromones are fast-acting and produce short-term behavioral changes, like repelling or attracting other individuals. Primer pheromones, on the other hand, work at a slower pace and cause longer-lasting hormonal changes in behavior or development. But while pheromones are supposed to aid in communication within a species, species, sometimes they can backfire and draw the attention of a different species. If this attention damages the signaling animal in some way, say by attracting predators or warning prey, that chemical is known as a chiromone. This might happen, for instance, when army ants, a highly social species, lay down a pheromone chemical trail so that wandering ants can find their way home. But sometimes that chemical trail also attracts a snake and leads it right to their door. Other chiromones seem to alert prey to the presence of predators, causing them to scatter or prepare to defend themselves. And other times, one species might actually mimic another species' pheromones in a kind of deadly romantic trickery, the way that female American bolus spiders imitate the love scent of a certain kind of moth to lure randy males into their sticky, ball-like webs. Some plants use this kind of deception, too. Not only do some orchid flowers look like bees, but they're also able to mimic female bee sex pheromones to attract males. Then, as the males try to get it on with the flowers, they inadvertently pick up and transport pollen, which is something we humans can use to our advantage. For years, entomologists have used pheromones to control agricultural pest insects. For example, releasing synthetic female hormones of certain moth species can confuse males and disrupt the mating process, which helps control the population. Pheromones may even help save human lives. Some researchers are looking at using these signaling chemicals to disrupt the life cycle of a nasty little parasitic nematode that spreads disease in humans and other species. So pheromones may help us humans protect our crops or fight parasites, and yeah, that's all pretty cool, but by now, you're probably wondering, if they can affect other animals so much, can pheromones score you a date? Well, no, probably not, but to be honest, we're not 100% sure. Turns out the idea of human pheromones is a very tricky business. It's likely that we do have pheromones, just because we're related to so many other mammals that do. But remember, no one has specifically identified a human pheromone molecule. There are a few well-known studies that seem to suggest that we have them, like a famous 1994 t-shirt sniffing experiment that suggested women prefer the scent of men with different immune system genetics than their own. There have also been lab trials involving androstenone, that male pig pheromone that we just talked about that makes the lady pigs go wild, and also happens to be found in human sweat. But these kinds of studies have had lots of problems. They often involve small sample sizes, poor experimental design, or just results that can't be replicated. In fact, some researchers think that the field of human pheromone work has become so controversial, even sensational, that we should scrap all the past studies and basically start over from scratch. And there's another problem with all this. We might not even have the right parts to detect pheromones in the first place. All vertebrates have a main olfactory system in some form of a nose, but many animals, including snakes, lizards, and rodents, also possess a special extra-sniffing organ called the vomeronasal organ, or VNO, that they use to detect pheromones. But humans probably don't have one, at least not one that works. We might start out with a VNO as fetuses, but most biologists agree that it disappears during fetal development. And even though some adults seem to have a kind of leftover vomeronasal cavity, it doesn't have sensory neurons and probably doesn't work. Still, in other animals, both kinds of sniffers ultimately send their signals to the same place, the amygdala, a major memory and motivation hub in the brain. And in animals that do have a VNO, we see a lot of overlap in pheromone and smell inputs. And some species actually do use their main noses to detect pheromones, so just because we humans and other primates don't have a functional VNO doesn't mean that we don't have pheromones. We certainly do send some messages via smell, like human newborns know the scent of their mother's breasts from across the room, humans and other mammals give off a pig pen-style cloud of personal molecules that give us unique scent profiles, which is why you might be able to tell who someone is just by their smell. But smells aren't the same thing as pheromones. Still, even if they aren't technically pheromones, these smells might act in a similar way by influencing our mating choices. A particular blend of things like secretions, bacteria, immune system genetics, food particles might make you more or less attractive to me. But the attractiveness of body odor also involves a lot of nuance, and how we feel about a smell often depends on our previous experiences with it. That's because the receptor cells in our nasal cavities shoot information to our brain's main olfactory bulb, which relays it to the parts of the limbic system right next to the memory-making hippocampus and the emotion-inducing amygdala. Which means scent is also rooted in memory. You might suddenly feel happy when you smell pancakes because that's what your family made on lazy Sunday mornings growing up, or feel attracted to the scent of sweat and sawdust because your sweetheart is a sexy lumberjack. In other words, we often respond to scents because of their context, not necessarily because of something about the molecules they're made of. Which is what makes them different from pheromones, when it is all about the molecules. Plus, humans are all about conscious choice. Like, I don't care if you smell like the best thing on earth, if I watch you kick a kitten, I'm not gonna feel any attraction to you. And losing my sense of smell, it would suck, but unlike for some animals that use pheromones, it wouldn't exactly destroy my life cycle or limit my social behavior too much. I would still have control over my choices. So if pheromones do influence our behavior, the effects are likely much more subtle. This fact fact, combined with the knowledge that humans are also greatly influenced by sight, sound, memory, learning, context, and social norms, is yet another reason why the potential existence and influence of human pheromones remains a bit of a mystery. So what's the next step in figuring out if we have them? Well, so far most human pheromone work has focused on the sex end of things, but as you might have noticed, humans are really complicated, especially adult humans. That's why French researchers are looking instead at babies and how chemicals secreted by nursing mothers affect sucking and mouth motion behavior in newborns. If a molecule from that secretion can be identified, synthesized, and shown to induce sucking and rooting behavior in any baby, then we might have our first official human pheromone. Either way, in the end, if you're looking to attract a date, I'd save money on anything marked as a pheromone boost and just work on polishing up your conversation skills.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. Hopefully, next week we'll be back and talking about AI and cars, laser-powered spaceships, meteorite murders, and more. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise, a morning.